This is a HeadGum Podcast.
You know that thing called underwear, right?
Heard of it.
Okay, so that's 365 days a year you gotta wear it, and you need it to be good without costing a lot. How are you gonna do that?
I don't know.
Maybe me undies?
Huh? What's that?
Me thinks me undies is the answer, my dear boy. And that's why they've created the world's most comfortable underwear luxury at half the retail price you'd find anywhere else. So MeUndies is made from...
Modal.
A fabric twice as soft as cotton, twice as soft.
You like
soft.
Cotton?
Then you're going to love MeUndies.
That's true.
It's got tons
it's better
of...
better than cotton.
Try a MeUndies. It's better than cotton. MeUndies has tons of colors, tons of styles. You can get matching pairs for men and women. That's a fun gift.
That's
or,
right.
Or weird gift to bring on a first date.
It's a pretty good gift.
That'd be fun, though. Like, go to a first date, bring matching underwear. I got you something.
Yeah. In worst case scenario, you come out of a day and you've got... the best underwear.
Awesome underwear. You can do it all. You can get black, stripes, tie-dye, polka dots, whatever you want. They got that kind of design. And they know that shipping sucks, paying for it does, so MeUndies has removed that from the equation, and all orders in the U.S. and Canada ship for $1 billion. No, I'm sorry. I'm reading that wrong. For free. They ship for free. So MeUndies has a money-back guarantee. If you don't love the first pair, you get to keep it for free, so you literally have nothing to lose.
Now that's a pretty sweet deal, but to sweeten the deal, MeUndies is offering you 20% off your first order. Guys, that's a fifth off. That's crazy.
20.
That's right. So just go to MeUndies.com/Gilmore, guys, and that's a special offer just for our listeners. You know, keep it on the DL. Unless you listen and tell all your friends while you're talking about how great the show is.
That is MeUndies.com/Gilmore, guys. So get some underwear and start feeling good.
Tell them the Gilmore guys sent you.
Hell yeah.
Kevin, my boy, your time is precious, and you want to feed your mind with the best of what's out there, but how could you do it? There's so much out there on the internet. I just found it the other day. You can do anything on the internet. You can make a meme. You can see a video if you want, but how do you get to the true good content?
Well, I'll tell you, Richard.
Yes?
Next issue. Next issue is a mobile app that lets you tap directly into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. That new tablet I bought you for Christmas, Richard.
Wonderful. What sort of magazines are on this next issue?
The greats like People, Time, Vogue, Esquire. And Next Issue lets you dive deeper into the story with interactive content for a richer reading experience.
Not a Richard?
A Richard. Well, probably Richard for in your case.
I hope so.
So, for example, Richard, because you like business so much, you'd probably want to read Forbes or Fortune.
I couldn't read them on... Is there a way for me to read them?
Yes, dude. They're all on Next Issue.
Wow.
Yeah, Bloomberg Market. You get a freaking Fast Company. You'd love that. So, Richard, here's what you can do. Here's what you can go as well. Go to nextissue.com/Gilmore, guys, and they're going to give you a free trial. You can start it right now. Repeat that back to me so I know you memorized
it. nextissue.com/Gilmore, guys.
You got it, dude.
Fascinating.
No. How tall do you think I am?
You look about 5'4".
Nailed it. I hear you, but I don't care.
Jahir.
I wish people would say that more. I hear you, and I don't care about that.
Yeah. It's an interesting point, however. It's not interesting to me.
Woo!
Done it again, y'all.
Okay. Yeah, I really got to get used to this thing.
I could get used to this.
I could.
La 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 la.
Gilmore guys.
La 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 la
la la la la. Hell yeah.
La 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 la
la la. Gilmore guys, volume 7. What
That's right, volume 7. Here's Kevin.
Here's Demi.
With a Simmy.
Just kidding.
Nah, 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 nah.
Truck. Simmy.
Right.
But I guess people don't call them Simmy trucks. They call them semi trucks, right?
I don't know. Yes. I'm gonna be more definitive. Yes.
I saw a movie all about semi trucks that come to life, or semi trucks that
Maximum
come to
Overdrive,
life.
Maximum Overdrive, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, it's worth watching. It really is for like so good they're bad.
Yeah.
Movies.
I my favorite kind of movie.
But like, there's a line where people cross sometimes. Like Sharknado 2 probably isn't that fun to watch.
The thing about Sharknado 2 and 3 is that they caught on and they're just like, let's just go all out, and it's just like,
yeah. It becomes less fun, right?
Yeah, there's a certain earnestness to trying and failing, mm-hmm. that is more fun to watch than trying and also being like, but we know we're going to fail.
It's like, if you're at a party, if you're at a family reunion with your uncle, and everyone's laughing at how stupid he is, and then your uncle's like, well, yeah, I know I'm stupid.
Yeah.
And he tries to play into it. It's like, shut up, uncle.
Then it's all of you making fun. Like, it's, you're not really making fun of anyone. You're just laughing at the idea that something could ever be so bad. When at one point right. it was.
Right. Is that a weirdly specific example?
Sure is. Aren't you an uncle?
It's true. I am to two gorgeous children, to Jude, big stars holla out to Hannah Paige Porter and Jude Robert Porter. Two kids so cute that I almost don't want to have children because I'm afraid I won't love them as much because they won't be as cute.
One day you'll get married and your wife will listen to this episode and just be like, so.
How about that?
It was a mistake to listen to the Gilmails.
You know, what we should do, I think, just in order to cover our bases, is I think we should do a segment maybe on Gilmails, maybe elsewhere, but probably on Gilmails is where they fit, is do a segment called Gilmail Goofs, or Gilmore Goofs, mm-hmm. rather. So Gilmore Goofs can be the segment where it's like, we got this wrong.
Yeah.
For example, one thing I'm thinking about that I think we've been responding to emails about is Jess and Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
So Gilmore Goof on our part. That's something I think mostly I have been attributing to, like,
I mean, me too.
Jess loves Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
That's not the case. So this email comes from Thais Alves, I want to say, but I might be mispronouncing it. The thing that's been bothering me... No, that's a different thing. Here's another Gilmore goof, actually. On one of the episodes before 205, you guys referenced the Iran-Contra affair as the Iran-hostage crisis, which were two very different things. Iran-Contra affair was Reagan. Hostage crisis was Mr. Carter.
Yeah.
But something we've gotten a lot of email about is Ayn Rand.
One thing about that is just... they are right, but part of me is just like, it's not a big goof.
It's not a big goof. Like, well, I understand that. That's not a big goof. But I do understand something like if us saying Jess loves Ayn Rand contributes right. to our dislike of him.
Yes.
Then that's a goof. So,
no, I'm saying the Iran thing. Like,
sure.
not a big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Ellen says, you guys, mostly Kevin, have been misattributing the love of Ayn Rand to Jess when it was Rory defending Ayn Rand and saying to Jess that Ayn Rand. Jess was saying to Rory that Ayn Rand was a political nut. Now, Jess is a lot of bad things, but one of his few redeeming qualities is that he doesn't like Ayn Rand. That's one of his few redeeming qualities, is something he doesn't like.
Right. Look, at least he hasn't murdered anybody.
So, we really shouldn't be depriving him of that redeeming trait, since the kid has so few others, is a quote from the email. So thank you, Ellen. So that's one of our Gilmore goofs. What was another one that we've had recently? Something we've gotten a lot of corrections on.
The poop thing from 501.
Oh, yeah.
We know. I don't know what happened in that moment that we were all just like, huh. I guess crap couldn't be a metaphor. But I
concur that that's probably the reality
yeah.
of the situation. However, I would still contend that it is a very awkward way to phrase it.
It was very strangely phrased, and it was out of a character
yeah.
that would have easily have meant the other thing.
yeah, but you could see it.
Yeah, if anyone else said it, we would have been like, oh, okay. But we would have joked about it
yeah.
being a shit thing. But
and you just don't hear that, or at least maybe now, maybe in 2004 you did, but at least now you don't hear like, oh, I got crapped on all over again at work.
Yeah.
You know? So maybe it was like, is the purest idea of that, I got shit on all over again by my ex-husband's, and then it's WB, and it's FCC, so we have to change that to crap all over. You know what I mean? Like, there's a few degrees of translation
plus
there.
Plus, it was a parallel between a baby literally crapping on someone, and so...
Yes! Oh,
it's
that's a
direct
a good point.
Translation
yeah.
from literal poop to... Yeah. metaphorical poop that we have to interpret on top of a weird phrasing. So give us some slack, although we recognize it.
We recognize
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't know what was in the air that day. Probably a gas leak of some sort that we were like, yeah. poop.
That was
poop.
A fun app.
It was. Man.
Good old Todd.
That said, yeah, some fun discussion came out of us mistaking that. And about the book thing, it's very hard not to conflate which dumb teenager in the show is reading what dumb book.
I think it is. Well, let's think about it. Because Lane's not really a bookie.
Right.
What does Lane... Doesn't Lane know how to read?
I mean, she knows how to read labels on some CDs.
She knows how to read the booklets.
That's true.
But you never hear Lane... Someone Gilmore goof us on this. You never really hear Lane raving about a book.
Right, which is fine.
Yeah.
Maybe she... I mean, she loves music. That's her thing.
Music makes the people come together, as Lady Madonna once said. Here's a major Gilmore goof, which I don't think we've talked about. But I think it's actually Amy Sherman-Palladino makes a Gilmore goof. So I'll read it. Let's say, had to ask you guys about something I consider to be one of the series' biggest Gilmore goofs, and no one's mentioned it. No one mentioned it in the season 4 finale or season 5 premiere. The alleged goof occurs during the Lorelai-Rory fight when Dean comes over to borrow Rory's virginity. When Lorelai, Rory brings up, oh, you know, you slept with Dad when he was with Sherry. Lorelai says he wasn't married to Sherry. And Rory says he was engaged and she was pregnant. They weren't engaged. That's false. Is that Amy Sherman-Palladino being like, yeah, they were probably engaged, whatever, I don't care. Or was that Rory having like an emotional reaction?
I think it was... an Amy mistake, but I don't think it's the biggest mistake. Like, it doesn't really change the narrative of the discussion or the world. I mean, it could very easily read as Rory just making a mistake because of that, or maybe she didn't. Maybe she thought they were engaged because she didn't know when Sherry got engaged. You know?
True. Okay. So yeah. So there's some latitude there, but just wanted to address it just so we complete the.
Yeah.
It's hard. I really want to be comprehensive, so there's not dangling threads like this.
Yeah.
That's why it's research is always important for us. This one just made me laugh. Emma wrote in. She said, "I was listening to 201 with Brian Husky, and loved his story about working with Scott Patterson. Out of curiosity, I Googled him, and found this phrase in his IMDb bio." Patterson also collects art, artifacts, and rare writings. His prehistoric petrified baby frog collection is on loan to the Louvre in Paris through 2010.
What the hell?
I'm going to read that again. His prehistoric petrified baby frog collection is on loan to the Louvre in Paris through 2010.
Through 2010. Oh, man.
So this was a while ago.
Yeah.
We should ask him about it.
Yes.
This is it's so strange.
That's so cool, though.
Prehistoric, petrified baby frog collection.
One-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
Oh, man. Oh, you know what? Here's one that we never addressed. This one's for Demi. Sorry, Kev.
Hey.
Is the subject line. Oh, I forwarded this to you. She says, "Hey, Demi. This really has nothing to do with Gilmore Girls, but you once said that you had a killer's phase in high school, and I'm currently in my high school killer's phase. Just wanted to ask you what your fave killer song was and why."
The Killers.
She says, "Mine is Rising Tide, Keep on Keeping On, Lauren."
I'm trying to even imagine Rising Tide. I think it's probably off Day and Age or like the bonus tracks or something. I shouldn't still know that. The Killers, I don't know if I mentioned, was the first band I ever saw live. Technically the second, because M83 opened for them. But I had a big Killers phase in high school, and then I moved on to the Strokes, and then I moved on to Radiohead. And now I'm just on to, you know, just general guttural screaming sounds and whatnot. Exactly. Love that. It's my favorite song. My favorite Killers songs were... Read My Mind was... I was obsessed with that for a long time. It was one of my favorite songs ever. Change Your Mind is also a good one, which is weird because they're same names but different albums. The Killers have so many good hits, and it was weird to me when they came up with their fourth album, and I just didn't listen to it. Fourth album being Battle Born, and not the... I don't count Sawdust as...
Because that's B-sides and stuff.
Yeah, but good B-sides. Yeah. Like, oh, boy. Really, they have so many good songs, and they had the, I think it's the Abbey Road sessions where they covered Dire Straits' Romeo and Juliet, and that was the first time I heard that song. It's a beautiful rendition. Yeah. I love
getting into songs where your entry point is the cover of it.
Yes.
That's how Scott Aukerman got into Bruce Springsteen.
That's how I first heard I'm Going Down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, same thing. Yeah.
And... actually, I can't believe I haven't said this, but the first time I ever heard Radiohead was in a Jay-Z mashup album. And that's how I got into Radiohead. Because I was just like, this is so great. And the beats are so good. And I looked up the beats and I listened to those. And I was like, Radiohead is so dope. And then I went back and listened to every Radiohead album. I was like, now they're my favorite band.
Yeah, at this point, do you regard them higher than you do Jay-Z?
Yeah, for sure.
Wow.
Yeah. But also, I barely think of Jay-Z as a rapper anymore. Just because
he's more of a personality.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a businessman. Not a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
I would be better equipped to talk about the Killers if I were looking at a list of their songs, but if anyone ever wants to have a Killers discussion, you know.
Is that like your Bruce? Like you could go on for hours and hours about them?
I don't know. It used to be my Bruce. My Bruce is Radiohead for sure. Yeah. But once upon a time, it was like my favorite band. And then the concert was so great, but I had a bad experience with it just in buying stuff and then getting it lost and then being weird with like my friends and whatnot, kind of just being sort of standoffish. And
wait, you bought merchandise, you lost it, then you were in a bad mood and you were kind of cold to your friends?
No, my friends were kind of cold to me, just in this weird way of like, I had a ticket that was in a very good spot and they had tickets that weren't in a great spot, so I went to sit with them and they were just kind of like it was weird. They were like hanging out with each other and I was trying to like talk with them and they were just doing the thing where it's like, oh yeah, cool, and then they just kind of go back to their it's a weird thing.
Well, that was high school.
Yeah, and I'm very much over it.
Yeah.
But like the big bummer of that was I bought a poster and a t-shirt both for like $60 total and then I lost I lost both of them, so I had to go back in.
Did you just leave it somewhere? And
well, I had the t-shirts longer. I genuinely don't remember how I lost the t-shirt, but I remember the poster was in a tube and I think I left it with someone and they were just like, I didn't know you left that with me. And I was like, I definitely did. I can't remember. I believe I still remember that. But then I went back to buy another t-shirt and I was like, I'm not going to get the poster. And I had to buy a size larger of a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. So I slept in that t-shirt. And I think I still have it from the Day and Age tour. Yeah.
And you know what? I have that t-shirt for you right now.
Kevin! I remember seeing you there.
No. I was there all along, Demi.
I'm going to steal this shirt and one day we'll work together and I'll give it back.
This is our origin story. There's so many fun points to our origin story.
There are.
We'll get into those.
Have we plugged a crash test yet on air?
No, we haven't.
Yeah.
Because it came out at a weird time when we were traveling.
That's true.
Right. So for those that don't know, and it's weird, by the way, and it was an oversight not to talk about it with Shear. When we had Paul Shear on our show,
yeah,
be like, hey, you're kind of the, you know, and I don't know if it'd be weird or not. This is literally 2 years ago, and I think we've talked about it on other shows or other podcasts or something, but Demi and I knew each other, and we, like, followed each other on Twitter and whatever.
We talked about the Douglas movies.
We talked about Douglas movies, Paul Tompkins, Electra Lemon, all that stuff. But where we actually physically met was at this Crash Test bus show, Rob Hubel and Paul Shear's bus show, and they were hosting it. It was such a fun night. It was like an 8-hour shoot, went till 4 in the morning. It was Aziz Ansari, Aubrey Plaza.
Really fun.
Seth Morse, Tom Lennon, Carlos.
No, it was Robert Ben-Gurion.
Robert Ben-Gurion as the Reno 911 characters. But not the Reno 911 characters. Like, they had to do, not technically
they were
those guys
because
of the copyright.
Police. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which Rob Hubel likes calling that show Reno 911.
Yeah, he does.
It's very funny. But that's where we met, and that special is now available for purchase on Vimeo for $3.99. A lot of it turned out great. I think my favorite part of that is, well, they cut out my favorite parts, which
the
were just
monologues?
The insane. The monologues?
Where they were, when he was dancing around to Unwritten with a mask on.
That was so funny.
That was my favorite part.
And they cut it out.
Down,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. My favorite part, hands down, though, was them sending Zev out.
Oh,
to
that was
freaking Hollywood and Highland.
By the way, that's all real. Like,
it's
I don't,
all real.
It's not staged at all. I saw Zev at UCB the other day, and I was just like, "Hey, I saw the special. You were great." And he's like, "Yeah, yeah, it was really fun." And on the bus, I remember laughing, but I also remember just being like, I can't believe he's doing this.
Because
like,
it was,
never,
like, dangerous at certain points.
I kept being like, I would never do this. I don't know anyone who would ever do it. But he was so, I was like, simultaneously, he's so brave and he's so foolish.
So we won't spoil what it is and do that annoying thing where people say, it's so funny, here's what happens.
Yeah.
And then you watch and you're like, oh, it would have been funnier. But, like, by the special, you can see reaction shots. CrashTestShow.com. You can see reaction shots of me and Demi on the bus. This was 2 years ago. This is November in 2013, and it's just coming out now. So it's part of our story, and it can be a part of your story. Was that a good way to
mention it in your memoir?
Yeah.
The time you watched it.
I remember watching Crash Test Bus. This next email comes from Tim Burr.
Tim Burton?
No, Timber Weiss, I think. Timber. I wonder if she's ever heard that joke. Or if
probably
it's a
not.
Dude. That's so gender norm of me.
It's going down. I'm yelling Timber.
So she writes, and her subject line is, maybe Rory isn't very intelligent at all. And she goes on to say, I'm well into season 5 and it hit me for the first time. Maybe Rory isn't that smart. I mean, obviously she's book smart, more than people smart, and she's an overachiever. I knew that. But in 4.5 seasons, has she ever come up with a great idea? Has she ever made a pithy intellectual observation about literature, about film, about anything? I think the answer might be no. Maybe Rory is studious, but unintellectual. Maybe she's just good at following instructions and memorizing shit. We've seen lots of examples of other characters being intellectually impressive in their various fields of expertise. Lorelai, Suki, Richard, Paris, Luke, etc. But not Rory. Now I've convinced myself that Rory is sort of a dum-dum.
I will say two things. One, that it seems like you, this person, and this is not to insult them at all, I feel like you just have very specific things of what you need to see to believe someone's...
It's a specific box to check, yeah.
I think she makes pithy intellectual... every time, like, every character does that thing where they'll just throw a reference, like, say goodbye to Daisy Miller. I, like, that's a very, like, I'm well-read sort of thing. I don't know what you mean by intellectual, I guess, in the sense that, like, if she's well-read, if she's studious, if she knows a lot of shit, she just doesn't ever need it. Like, is that intelligence or is that just, like, preparedness? It's like hibernation of knowledge.
I guess it's like, I think the more salient idea, or maybe the more clarifying idea, is book smarts versus street smarts.
Yeah.
Because Timber does make a good point in that all those characters have expertise in their field.
Yeah.
They're all good at their jobs, and you see little examples of that sprinkled out. But you never, just like we talked about in 506, you never really see Rory like crushing it. You know what I mean?
And that's, I think, a problem of the right, like, they don't care. They really are just like, it's a backseat to the more interesting stuff of her relationships, which, like, even when they put her, like, intellectual life in the forefront, it's really just a small thing, like her getting an A and she's like, I don't know if I deserved this. It's weird because, like, we think she does. We've been told that she's brilliant. She's at Yale. I think she might deserve it, but like, that's such a small thing. They're just like, this isn't really important. Let's get back to a relationship, which is also maybe just a factor of them knowing that this is what people want to see. And it's not necessarily a problem with the show. It's just them going like, look, people are responding to Luke and Lorelai. People are responding to Dean and Rory.
But I think there's ways to still support the idea that Rory's good at something.
Yeah.
While not taking away from any of those stories. Or time-wise or relevance-wise or any of that.
Yeah.
I guess it's tough. It does strike me as we're saying this that, just to be comprehensive, one thing we didn't mention in 506 when talking about like examples of Rory being good at writing and stuff, I guess the A she got from Asher would be an example of that when he says, I thought your thesis was excellent and your points were clear and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So I guess you've seen that. So I just want to mention that.
It is weird that we don't get any indication that she's smarter than everyone telling us she is.
Mm-hmm.
But I also just wonder, like, do they care? Like, do we need to, if she's shown to be intelligent, she drops all these references everywhere, what else would we get? Like, I get that it's not a street smart thing, and that's the problem that we never see here actively, like, using this intelligence. But what would they do to show that she has studied history or, like, is really good at writing? Like, how would that come into play in a natural way?
I guess it's harder because she is still a student while all those other people that Timber listed are actually doing their jobs in the real world.
Right. And all those, like, she's academic smart. Everyone else is doing things that show they're good in their field, and those fields aren't necessarily like, I know a lot about whatever. It's just, I'm very good at dealing with people. I'm very good at making a thing. I'm very good at, you know, running a business. Mm-hmm. None of those are really academic.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get into this little anecdote. I've never heard so much about Peyton Place in my life since doing this show.
Oh, my God. I know.
I love it. This is a fun little story from Kathy, who says, I haven't thought about this show for 31 years.
What?
Wait.
Oh, I thought you meant Gilmore Girls. I was like, what?
Oh, wait a minute. I totally misread that. It says, Pain Place, I haven't thought about that show for years because I'm 31, not 71. But when you brought it up, it brought back this memory of my youth in a small Stars Hollow-y town. A gentleman had a barn in a field right at an intersection, and on the side of it, spray painted 3 miles north, Peyton Place. And it was there for years until someone sold it to someone who painted it over immediately. I'm not sure if he was disgruntled or just had an odd sense of humor. My parents were always vague about him. So while not that many people got the Peyton Place reference, there's a small population of people in their 20s to 40s in Virginia who drove by that barn every day and asked their parents what the hell Peyton Place is.
Because he wasn't the painted place.
Because no one knew what the hell Peyton Place was. So I just love that idea of like, okay, Peyton yeah. Place. I tried to find a picture of it online, but sadly no one has had the foresight to preserve this image for future reference. So guys, Peyton Place is everywhere. Maybe, Kathy, the correct answer is like Peyton Place. It's also a TV show. It's also a blah, blah, blah.
But it's
also, yeah, a book is a blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
In that sense. But maybe it's also a gang. And maybe they tagged that barn. Maybe it wasn't that farmer.
Shouldn't come around Peyton Place, son. You come on the block, you get hit.
Let's talk about...
Sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all
the... Flummoxed in Florida. You put this in the folder, right?
I guess.
This is the one about the couple?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Should we read this?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is from Catherine. She says she's a recent listener. However, I just listened to 304, and I have to say, y'all kind of bum me out. You see, I will soon be celebrating my one-year wedding anniversary with my high school sweetheart. Cue surprise music. She puts an asterisk. Well, I wouldn't recommend it to everyone, and I'd put 1,000 disclaimers on it. I do feel like my husband and I got to build something very special by choosing to stay together during our teens and early 20s. We each had to make sacrifices and learn to grow together at a very early age, but we also maintained our independence from one another. For example, I went to school in South Carolina, and he went to a college in Tennessee. I studied away 3 times. He traveled to Russia and Thailand, stands to myself, and he was deployed to Afghanistan for the majority of my senior year. We lived apart for almost a year after we got married. While I finished my master's degree in North Carolina, and he was stationed in Florida. So the moral of the story, don't dog on high school sweethearts. I know it seems like a crazy choice. Trust me, I did a lot of soul searching about it in college. It honestly did work out for the best. I have an amazing husband who supports me 200%, and I couldn't be happier. Plus, we get to share all those wonderfully awkward high school memories together, not to mention the corny prom pictures. That being said, I still love y'all's podcast. And I recommend it to people. Thanks so much. And then she attached a picture of her and her husband, and it's so sweet.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's a good thing to read.
Yes.
I hadn't read that email before.
I added it to the list of things to address on this episode just because, A, I don't remember what specifically we said about it.
I don't remember
it.
Either, but that was 304, which is
I
like
vaguely
long,
remember
yeah.
it because Trolley was involved, and I vaguely remember saying – like, I don't think that – I hope I didn't say that all high school sweethearts are a dumb idea, because what I think I should have said, if I didn't already...
This is probably
that,
both of us, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting married very young to your high school sweetheart is a risky proposition, because growing in high school is so different from growing in the real world. So getting married at a time when you are, like, you may be head over heels in love, but it's still young love, and you really haven't been able to grow... alone is difficult to do, because then you have to do all this growing that you should be doing alone with another person, like legally and spiritually joined to you. And again, this is not like I'm not a relationship expert, and like fuck me for all I know. Don't
we're
even,
both single guys,
right? Do not take this as me saying like here's the gospel or anything.
Here's what you got.
I just think that getting married at 19 is insane. No matter how like in love you are with someone, you have so much growing to do, and it's like a very easy way to get divorced if you just kind of like if you like you jump headfirst into a thing at such a young age. And that's not to say like, yo, if you're with a high school sweetheart, you know, dump them or anything, because again, you can grow with someone and be in that relationship and it can feel like a marriage, but actually like putting a certificate to it is like saying it's the ultimate confident move. You know, it's just the idea that you were like, I don't even need to grow anymore. I'm ready at 19 is insane. Again, it has worked for some people and those people are very lucky, but oh, it's just the idea that it would ever be the kind of thing that isn't worthy of a little scrutiny is just kind of insane to me. Like, their example is very different, and you guys, obviously, you're happy, and that's terrific, and I'm glad. It's not the same, because you said you were married, it seems, through after your, you know, early 20s and whatnot. Anyway.
They stuck together. Well, I would expand that to say, too, just in general, because you said getting married that young is a risky proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Getting married is a risky proposition,
right,
regardless of circumstance. So,
but less so.
But sure, yeah. Right. Is what I'm saying. Like that, it adds a factor to it. But then you could play the other side of that and say, like, if you go with someone who you've known for a long time, is integrated in your world, maybe knows your family already, I could see safety in that in a way that, like, maybe reshapes the way your brain grows. So your life isn't about self-actualization, but is also about pursuing the things you desire, but also serving someone else in that relationship. So, you know, like, yeah, but I totally understand, probably concur on a lot of what you're saying about, like, it just adds a factor that makes a risky proposition even a little bit riskier.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to hear rebuttals to two dumb dudes in their 20s like Catherine's because obviously that happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know what? I wanted to read this one because this was a lovely story. This is from Kelly with two E's. One at the front, one the Keely. That's like Kimmy Schmidt's dad or uncle. Who is it, that sheriff, that's like, Kimmy?
Oh, yeah. She's also named Kimmy, but we switched the I and the Y.
Right, but you know how he pronounces, like Kimmy.
Kimmy, yeah.
Kimmy. So she says, a couple years ago, my grandmother was nearing the end of her life, and I was frantic to feel useful. After talking with my mom about her funeral arrangements, I asked if there was an outfit she had that she always wanted to be buried in. My mom smiled slightly and said, she said she always wanted to be warm. What a strange request. Or rather, she always said she wanted to be warm, I thought. And it immediately put me in the mind of Lorelai's grand wanting to be buried in fresh clothing. After further discussion, we decided to bury her in a new pair of pajamas and a house coat because that's what she wore to the end. As my husband and I were together in the department store shopping, I'd wandered away from him while looking around. I was getting tearful, thinking about the errand, when he walked up behind me and said, "Do you know what this makes me think of? That episode where Lorelai shops for her grandma's clothes for her funeral." The fact that he remembered it and made the same reference I had earlier with my mom broke my discomfort briefly, and a giggle escaped, or a gilly chuck, I would say, escaped, along with a few unshed tears. Also, because of the episode, I made sure that we got her underwear to match her outfit because I didn't feel right about my grandma going commando either. Thank you, Gilmore Girls, for helping me in a seriously emotional and odd situation in my life. And by the way, this is the girl, she says in the PS, great job in the F's for the fashion report. Whether my voicemail from a while ago helped or not, I'm taking a little bit of credit. Remember she sent that voicemail in about the exercises?
Helps. Yeah. I mean, we don't do it every time, right, but it helps to at least be like get in sync about it.
I love that. By the way, points. Points. Chris Hardwick. Points.
Again, I love your impression of him falling to earth.
Points. Points. Points to her husband for freaking referencing that.
That's how you help someone deal with grief.
I feel meeting them where they are.
Yeah.
Totally. And again, it just speaks to the very reflective nature of this show.
Yeah.
Like, you don't watch Gilmore to go, you do to go to a different world, but then also to see your own world reflected, I think is a big comfort and a part of what makes the show work. So Gary writes in and says, "Dear Mr. Birbiglia and Mr. Burris."
Oh, yeah. Which I don't know what that Is it a comment on our voices?
Yeah, I think okay. so. Because I think we talked about one time a listener wrote in.
Oh, yeah.
And referred to us as My Propiglia.
I believe that.
Demi, what you should have said was nothing.
Nah, what I should have said was more than I actually said, I believe.
People say, Hannibal, you can't like Gilmore Girls. I'm like, fuck you, I can like Hannibal.
People tell me I can't like a show that's about girls. Man, I like girls. Why can't I like a show about girls?
That's good. That's so good. A couple of quick comments.
Here we go.
If Lorelai and Rory were to play Pokemon...
Oh, I remember this email.
Which
yeah.
starter Pokemon do you think they would choose between? Bulbasaur, Squirtle, or Charmander? I have my response, but I hope to hear yours first.
We
Jess would somehow pick Pikachu because he's a rebel.
I was going to say we'd have from Lord... so, all right. Rory would go with Venusaur because it's the environmental option. She'd probably have some weird thing about how the environmental aspects of Venusaur will somehow outlast the easy to put out fire and the very easy to drain, you know, water of both Squirtle and Charmander. And then Lorelai would have some dumb thing about, like, can I pick the rat or can I pick the electric one? And he's like, no.
Why can't I thought this through?
I'm literally thinking of this all okay. right now. But she'd be, Professor Oak would be like, no, you can't do that. Why not? You got one right there, you know? Just let me have one of those. Everyone gets one of these, but if I just have one of those, then I get a little start up on the people, you know? Everybody's got the rat or the, everyone's got the fire rat, the water rat, the green rat. Just give me the, you know, the thunder rat. I can shock them all. You want me to be good at Pokemon, you know, you give me more options than these three or something like that. And it'd be like, Lorelai, you can't have... In this scenario, Luke is Professor Oak. It's like, Lorelai, you can't have... Lorelai, you got to start with these and then work your way up to the rat. It's like, well, it feels like I don't want to play at all, honestly. And then maybe eventually goes, fine, give me the fire one. Maybe I can just set the other ones on fire and steal myself a thunder rat or something. What were the other questions?
I think that was the best one from that email. I don't know anything about Pokemon other than what I see when I throw the Pokeballs in Smash Brothers.
Oh, man, I was big.
Do you like Smash Brothers?
Oh, I love it.
That's the only video game I feel like I can play
anymore.
I used
to have parties where I'd have a bunch of people over at my house.
Smash parties?
Yeah, we have like multiple TVs going playing Smash, just a bunch of my friends.
And Broadway fans would come.
Yes.
Getting confused.
Fade in on Pokemon.
Mario.
Yeah, exactly. but that was a fun thing that I did in middle school a lot.
This from Lacey. I love this. So she said, this is only tangentially related to the show, but I have to share. Since I started listening, I can't stop noticing how bad Netflix synopses are for other movies and TV shows besides Gilmore Girls. Whoever is writing this is tripping over themselves to sound cool and hip. And it's both hilarious and infuriating. I also accidentally find myself reading them in Kevin's dumb Jess voice, even though she's Team Jess, is what she says. Oh, Dirty Dancing. So she shares a few that have made her LOL recently. So these are Netflix synopses that Lacey has transcribed for us, and these are all real. No bit zone. So for Dirty Dancing, here's the... Also, Kenneth Ortega, Kelly Bishop, connection. What's there for a shy, innocent daddy's girl to do at a codger-filled summer resort? Bump, grind, and grow up real fast.
Is this a transcription of, like, the commercials for Dirty Dancing that were
That's
on TV or something?
Like. That's what it sounds like.
What's there for a daddy's girl? Bump. Like, that's not... That doesn't tell me what the movie... I mean, it kind of does, but it doesn't really...
Not really.
Doesn't sell me on the... Anyway, just give me a straightforward... It's about a woman who dances to escape her rich lifestyle. I don't like.
I would love if a synopsis was just like for a movie so known and revered. The synopsis was just you get it
right. Yeah, The Dark Knight.
Yeah,
come on, it's Batman.
It's Batman. You'll catch up. For Annie Hall, it is a nebbish with cool. killer jokes meets a gal. Who wears ties like nobody's biz, B-I-Z. A little neurosis never heard a love story.
That sounds like Logan wrote it.
Wait a minute.
A nebbish with a, what is it? Like nobody's biz. A little someone never heard a love story. Give me the scoop.
Oh, when he's doing the bit.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
When you said a nebbish, I thought it was going to say a nebbish something.
That's what I thought too.
That's weird.
Maybe she left a word out, but I like to think she did not.
She was a tie like nobody's biz.
Labor Day, the classic Jason Reitman movie. Was that Jason Reitman?
Yeah, that was like 2 years ago.
It's a movie that's all but... Isn't it weird how people forget that certain movies existed?
Yes.
Like, when I think of Jason Reitman's last movie, I think like...
Up in the Air.
Oh, yeah, Up in the Air. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anna Kendrick, Clooney, love it. But there was Labor Day. There was that one about phones.
Young Adult.
No, yes, there was.
Yes.
Young Adult with Charlize Theron.
I don't know why I forgot about that. Maybe because I liked Up in the Air more.
And also the one about texting with Adam Sandler.
Oh, Men, Women, and...
Children.
Yes. Yep. Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
What happened?
Time for the right cast.
I like Jason Reitman, but I don't know what happened.
Someone said if he doesn't right the ship, that he's going to be known as the guy who does the live reads at LACMA, which is a bummer. Yeah. But for Labor Day... the synopsis is, a lonely rural mom gets tied up by her new lover. Moody fugitives with access to rope tend to do that.
Jesus. Don't. So they were just like, this is a pun. And then they're just kind of making jokes, I guess, which is fun maybe for like an April Fool or like a just like we're the cool streaming service. But also just I do want to know what the movie is about.
Right. And like what's the brand? Like to me, Netflix represents like their UI and everything. It's like clarity, simplicity. Mm-hmm. And this just seems like just do one sentence for these movies. And she says, here's a bonus for being bad in a completely different way. Best kept secret. Do you know this movie?
No.
I don't. But the synopsis is no life skills and nowhere to go. They're almost adults, but on the autism spectrum. She's one devoted teacher. It's like a weird haiku.
What?
I don't know what this movie... And so as two people who've never seen this movie and not familiar with it, it's like, what the hell? Like, what the hell, Netflix?
A teacher on the autism spectrum has a secret?
I don't know. I mean, it's...
Okay, I'll look this movie up later. I'm very confused.
It's bad. Megan writes in, I love this question, actually. I think this is very good. She likes when the random tangents turn into insight. Who knows if it will. But the question is very good, so thank you, Megan. She says, can a sense of humor have a gender? A few weeks back, one of my male friends said that my sarcastic sense of humor was masculine in that what I'm sure he wasn't meaning to be a dig, but I certainly took as one. So what do you think? Can a sense of humor be masculine or feminine? If so, why would sarcasm be the thing that makes it lean masculine? Also, I realize this might be taken as similar to your earlier debate about whether guys like funny girls, but I think this is different enough to consider as its own topic.
I don't think that it's similar just because... I think one's about, like, attraction. This one's just about the idea that...
Yeah, this one's broader.
Humor is even... Like, I don't think a sense of humor, like, even just the style of someone's, like, comedy or funniness can be tied to a gender. But I think it's that paired with what they're talking about when they do it. Like, some people see, like, sort of, like, catty sarcasm as a female... like, a female form of humor... Like, in the sense that, like, people would just be like, I'm a very sarcastic woman, and, you know, that's just my style. But I don't think it's necessarily that as much as it is what you choose to be sarcastic about, you know?
It's the... So you think...
I think it's the subject matter, not necessarily the...
Yeah, it's the object of ridicule rather... Yeah.
Yeah, because I know people who have very similar sense of humor, and they are, you know, they're very different in every other way, including their gender.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a matter of... person. You know, like, I don't think if there are a million male versions of, like, Aubrey Plaza's whole, like, deadpan, sarcastic, you know, death-obsessed thing. And I think they don't get as many comparisons because people see it as different because she's a woman. But it's not necessarily a masculine sense of humor. It's just a sense of humor that is attributed to her more often than...
I guess it's like if a guy... If men tend to play more in a certain genre of comedy where it's like, hey, well, the Birbiglia thing, you're fat, you're gay, I'm out of here,
yeah.
like zingers or like ridiculing people.
Right.
Just because guys do it more, does that make it male? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, is chocolate a girl food because girls might eat it more? Like, on a statistical level. Right. You know what I mean?
It's all about context.
Yeah. So
I'm specifically now thinking of like the type of John Mulaney joke, which I guess Logan tries to do, where he's just like imitating imitating the 50s style and saying a real weird thing, like Madge said to beat it, bozo.
But the thing is, Mulaney talks like that all the time.
Right, and it's great when he does it, and it's sort of like I don't know why it's one of the things that makes him my favorite comedian. But I can't see a woman doing that, but I also wouldn't, if I saw a woman doing it, go, that's a very masculine joke, you know?
Right, and I think it's regressive to do so. Like is Chelsea Peretti more of like, oh, it's kind of dude humor because sometimes she razzes audience members or people? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, no. It's just, and I think that needs to be the case, especially with how like imbalanced certain comedy structures are now. Like, we just need to, probably the most healthy way to look at a sense of humor or a style of humor is like, it's just a style, and to remove gender from it, because then everyone can play with all the same colors and play in the same sandbox. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you're like, if you're a guy, you can't talk about like Netflix is my boyfriend or something better than that. Something that like might be more traditionally attributed to like a female, or like, right, I'm dying alone, LOL, you know, like everything needs to be like available. Like, everyone needs to feel the freedom to tap into the same palette.
Yeah.
Colbert has 19 writers, 17 of them are women. Or I'm sorry, 17 of them are men, 2 of them are women.
Yes. I was going to say, well, I don't think that's true.
And all of them are white, which, as much as I love Colbert, what do you think that's a function of when that happens? Like,
Hollywood just having a large pool
New York
of white men. I mean, Hollywood is a figurative.
Just showbiz? Industry,
yeah. Showbiz as always being just a sort of thing that's been run by. And I don't think they're purposefully being like, you know, we want white men in here. But I do think they're just kind of like, maybe it is literally just that. And, you know, someone wrote something about this, specifically talking about UCB Improv. I think it was Will
Hines.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. Will Hines wrote a thing.
I have a Will Hines impression. It's not great. Kind of sounds like our class.
I was going to say. he wrote a thing because someone wrote to him saying, like, it seems like it might be difficult for a woman or a person not of color to, you know, progress in improv. And
a person of color.
Right, a person of color, yeah, to progress in improv. And I don't think that's a function of them purposefully trying to do it that way, but it's sort of a,
yeah, it's not like
of,
Mike Stills over at Sunset, like, more whiteies.
Yeah.
You know,
it's simultaneously a function of them being the overwhelming majority, and, you know, not wanting to just pick out the rare seeds just because you think, you know, why not give them a chance when you have a bunch of people in front of you that you're like, you know, like, of this group, there's someone in there that can do it, and you don't necessarily have to be like, well, I'm not going to give it to you because I want to, maybe they can do it. It's this, it's like reverse affirmative action almost. But also, Will Hines said a thing that like really stuck with me, which is that women and minorities necessarily aren't pushed to be funny from a young age like white men often are. You know, they are not rarely seen as like, oh, he's such a class clown, or oh, he's like, I mean, when minority men are, it's kind of not necessarily they're punished for it, but they're kind of seen as like, he's a troublemaker of some sort. But when like white men from a young age are not taught to be funny,
I understand what you're saying, because Christopher Hitchens made a RIP, I guess. No, yes, RIP.
we have this. So, yeah, continue.
He made a similar argument that Vanity Fair, that it was so, it was like a clickbait headline. It was like, why women aren't funny. Ugh. And his argument wasn't that they're not, it's just there's less of them. And the argument behind that was kind of the same thing, that, yeah, women from a young age were not encouraged to be funny.
A reinforced thing.
They were encouraged, yes, to be pretty, because guys are encouraged to be funny, because that's attractive to women. And women are encouraged to be pretty because that's attractive to men, traditionally. And that's what it counts for. So is Will Hines making that same sort of thing?
I think he's making that
same sort of point.
And saying also that, like, it's not a matter of them being better. It's about it's a matter of them being more. You know, like, women make it through, but a lot of, like, there's not, like, statistically as many women because
right,
it's such
okay.
a men's club. And, like, men get involved in comedy because from a young age they are told that they are very funny. Whether or not they are stand out funny, they're just told, like, they're reinforced that them being funny is their thing, you know? How many men, like, how many male friends do you have that are just like, one day I'm going to be on SNL, dude. You know I'm funny. Tell me I'm funny. And I don't see as many women like that, although they exist, but they are very, I think they're more, like, performative about it. They're just kind of like, I think I'm a good actress, and also I love SNL, or I wish I could be on SNL. Too bad it won't. Like, men dream of being on SNL, women dream of being on SNL, but they also kind of see it as like, but that'll never happen. And that's what I've seen as like a pattern. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a factor of, you know, how kids are treated and how, like, what behaviors we reinforce in men and women growing up. And I think it's so crazy that we don't tell women, they're like, girls, they're funny from a young
right.
age.
But, which is not to discount the evident sexism that there is in the industry.
You're right.
Often. But the idea that, like, are there no female late night hosts in any of the big major network slots because we want to keep women out of them, or because the candidates were, I mean, truth be told, Amy Schumer and Amy Poehler were asked to do Daily Show before Trevor Noah.
Didn't they both turn it down?
They both turned it down.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to do it.
Part of me feels like they don't see a woman as worthy of filling that spot until she's big enough that she would never want to fill that spot, you know?
That's so interesting. I mean, that's true.
Right, because
the
people they want on those would be the people who are the women who have already proved themselves to the world.
Yeah.
I don't think they're willing to give, like, a Cameron Esposito a shot, you know?
That's okay. See, now this is something that isn't talked about a lot. Yeah. Because Conan was no one. Yeah, I mean, he was a Simpsons writer and
right.
he did SNL. But he had he had 5 minutes of on-screen talent.
I'm pretty sure Craig Ferguson, too. I might be wrong about that.
Well, he was more of an actor, but I understand
okay,
what you're
yeah.
saying. Yeah, but, you know, he was on Drew Carey for like 10 years or
right.
whatever. But yeah, at the same time, and I understand Colbert, like, getting that over whoever
yeah.
you want to name. Because it's like, oh, he had a proven commodity.
Yes. He was top a of the talk show host.
Yeah, top commodity for 10 plus years. Like, it, in a way, kind of couldn't have gone to anyone else.
But even the fact that he got that previous show without, like, I mean, what was he doing before the Colbert Report?
He was doing Daily Show.
Yeah.
I see that as a natural extension, though.
Maybe, but why was, like, I guess there is now, but Samantha Bee was way later.
Samantha Bee, and then Chelsea Handler's doing the Netflix thing.
Yeah, although Chelsea Handler had a show, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So already kind of proven. But that's an interesting discussion, that people in seats of power would not take a risk on a woman.
And they see women as more of a risk. They're just like, they got to, I think it's not just Hollywood, but I think it's the world. I think they genuinely, and maybe this is just based on statistic, the world has signified that they are, like, they see women as like a, I don't know if I'd watch a TV show hosted by women until they can prove that they are funny and, like, a power player, like Tina Fey or Amy Poehler. And by the time they do that, why would they host a talk show? Why would they not star in a bunch of movies or write their own TV show or do something that is not... And that's not to say talk shows are bad, but it's also just this kind of thing of, like, people rise by doing a talk show. Like, Jimmy Fallon was popular, but he wasn't Jimmy Fallon until...
Sure.
You know.
And it's a weird snake eating its tail, because if you're a little girl... If you're a little girl, Demi.
Right. Thinking about it.
Playing about it. No, but, like, 40, 30, 20, 10 years ago and today, if you're a little girl watching late night television and you're looking at all these talk show hosts, you still have no model.
Right.
So all these guys currently had models. Everyone looked up to Letterman. Everyone looked up to Carson. Everyone looked up to, and you can more easily see yourself in that position. So maybe, like you're saying, because there's no model of that, specifically in the talk show host realm, less people have that ambition.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, like, Schumer didn't want to, she didn't want to be the Joan Rivers film, or, you know, because there was no model.
You know what I also am thinking about now that I find interesting is the fact that every late night host wears a suit. And that's not only, like, a fancy sort of, like, gala thing, but it's also, like, a man of power, like, a man that you trust sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Would they put a female late-night talk show host in a suit or a pantsuit or make them wear, like, a dress? And if they make them wear a dress, does that sort of, you know, to the world, does that tell them, like, this isn't – it's not a serious thing. Like, she's looking pretty because you should look at her more than listen to
her. Yeah, like, the symbology goes that deep.
Right.
And it's interesting because, like, who is the most powerful person in daytime TV right now? Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah.
Who wears suits.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
See, there's a lot
but
to
even
that.
Even daytime is less respected. It's a fluff sort of thing.
Yeah, but
and that's the market ruled
did
by
they
women.
Not go after Ellen for Letterman?
I don't know.
Or for The Late Show? I don't know.
If I were Ellen, I would turn them down.
For late night?
Yeah. Ellen makes more money than anyone in that, like, even range of television. And
really? I didn't know that.
She's way well known as to moms and to, like, she has her thing and she owns it and no one does it as well as her. So for her to be like, I'm giving that up, I'm going to do interviews with politicians and stuff on late night is a risky move.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of changing the – it's a big change, I think, it would be for her if she did that.
It's so funny how few people believed in her when she started.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just remember the mood just being like, no one's going to want to watch a lesbian in daytime. It's just a bunch of everyone's mom loves Ellen. It's just like a given.
She's a household name.
Yeah.
Her
just
first
like,
name.
Just like, the dude that cracks up in SNL sketches, it's not going to work. And then she, you know.
I mean, people still think it doesn't work. I think they're wrong, but still.
Prom King comedy?
Well, I mean, that and they think that Jimmy Fallon is insignificant, like is in what's the in? They don't think they think he's.
I know what you're going after.
Right, they don't believe he's genuine. Insincere. Yeah, insincere. They think he's insincere when he's like really laughing in an interview.
I don't think he's insincere.
I honestly believe he's sincere. Everything I've ever heard about him said like just suggests that he's just a goofy. Like he like these are stories. Like when he has a story with someone, he's genuinely laughing because he thinks it's funny,
right.
And he's in the mindset. Like you've been talking to a friend, and you're like in that mindset of being really excited, and you laugh at something that if you heard in a different mood, you'd be like, "Oh God!" And I think that when you are watching that TV, that's the mood you default to. But when you're in the moment, and you have an audience, and you are hyped up, and you are being performative, you laugh because it is genuinely funnier than it is watching at home.
Totally.
So it just comes off as ingenuine.
And you know how that really struck me is when we went to that taping.
Yeah.
Because sweet Mike DiCenzo hooked us up with some tickets to a taping of The Tonight Show when we were in New York City a few months ago. And truthfully, I never disliked Fallon as a host. I always thought he was good and valuable. But that taping actually made
me... Was it Tig Notaro that was... Or was that...
Yeah, Tig was the stand-up and... the guest. And
yes.
It was great. And then Trevor Noah was the other guest and they pre-taped other stuff.
Him talking with Tig is what made me think like, no, this is genuine. Just the story of him, like him initially being embarrassed to be like, I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Yeah.
But also just like remembering the night. And I'm just like, that sounds like a real story. It doesn't sound like something they wrote.
Right. Like, and not to create division or like go after particular people, but the person who kind of started this conversation, who coined prom king comedy, a Conan writer. When is the last time Conan has been sincere in an interview? It's been a decade at this point.
Yeah.
Like, he's reading cards. Jimmy's present. And truthfully, what I was going to say is the taping of Fallon made me... it didn't make me respect him when I didn't before, because I did. But it made me see the utter value of what that is in the space that he creates. Even just going back and forth with... announcer.
Of Conan?
No.
Steve Higgins.
Steve Higgins.
Yeah,
I found. Going back and forth and seeing the looseness. And yeah, it made it seem unprepackaged. Even though, like, you can think this bit is funny and this isn't, or you can think the interviews are fluff. But then at the same time, it's almost like a masterful. Yeah, it's like we have 5 minutes for an interview segment. Let's just do a game.
Right.
You know, like, I so see the value of that. And even being in that studio audience and seeing the people laughing there and seeing the crew and seeing the way that worked, and then us, you know, with Mike, I totally see the value of that in a way that I undervalued before, and how that's necessary. Like, not everything is going to be like, oh man, then we dropped a truth bomb and then comedy was punk rock and then blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's good for all time zones, and that's just as valuable. Movies that hit all four quadrants, you know what I mean? Like, are insanely valuable. Like, right. Pixar movies are insanely valuable that they can achieve all those things.
Plus, late night television works in a fashion now where you, like, no, not people don't really watch it live unless they have a reason to stay up. And sometimes just having a good guest isn't a reason to stay up anymore. You know, you get it on YouTube or whatnot. So they need to do things that it's just like you will not see anywhere else. You won't see Tom Cruise singing The Weeknd anywhere else. You won't see Tom Cruise smashing an egg on his face anywhere else. It's fun. People want to see it, and it helps them keep the show afloat so they can do all the other things.
Which, by the way, that in and of itself is silly and remarkable.
Right.
To be able to create a safe enough space and to create an environment where you're going to be like, let's do this stupid gag. Let's do this fun thing. Let's do this silly thing. And that the world's biggest stars, that the first lady, that the president of the United States is like, oh, this is safe and fun, and I will not come out looking like a fool, and I trust this show and I trust this host. That is an achievement.
Yeah.
You know, that I, you know, people have had to various degrees, but I don't think to the level that Fallon has.
No, definitely not.
So, what was the question?
It was about
Whether
gendered sense of humor.
Gendered sense of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which, by the way, just to wrap that up, I'm so interested to see how Colbert, because Colbert, he wrote this piece for Glamour. Did you read it? How he wants to champion
the voice
of women. All the while having two female writers.
Right.
Like, I don't believe, I probably to a fault trust the heart and mind of Stephen Colbert and his sincerity, which I think he has an equal measure to Fallon's.
Here's what I can also say to that is that At Midnight does a similar thing where they will, or Chris will go on a pedestal about, you know, women's rights or gay rights or even just about how insensitive certain things are happening with minorities in the media. All the while, behind the scenes, there are two women writers max at any given time, no people of color, and to my knowledge, no gay people on the staff. And I don't think that's, again, it's a factor of really
It's not
just,
hypocrisy.
It's not, although they should really try to make it less, one faceless figure of a person in a room. And I think that really the way to there's so many things where it's like you can't properly talk about certain issues if you don't have a writing staff that can firsthand tell you how you should deal with those issues, which is one of my things that gets frustrating to me on our show, but I mean I can't say anything about it. But it's just this weird thing of like, you know, you get visibly scared to address, you know, the plight of black people because you're not sure how to deal with it, and you would if you had a black writer or whatnot. And it's just strange to me that, you know, people like staffs like that will, you know, they'll be like, well, we got to do the right thing and take on this. But also you see that you can take on it a lot easier and a lot more frequently, and you can be bold about it if you take the necessary steps to put those people that you want to defend in the room so that they can help you defend it.
It sounds like you're pitching yourself as a writer for admin.
That's one of my reasons that I don't ever bring it up, because I don't want people to
because
think,
it's so sensitive.
Well, no. Well, I'm also just like, you know, I don't want to be like, hey, I'm taking this to the top.
You're saying that you don't bring up this particular topic of conversation so it doesn't come off like that. I don't think it does.
Right, right. I know. But I'm worried that it would if I ever, like,
sure,
which is not, it's whatever.
Yeah, but people need to trust your heart and stuff. But I understand. And yeah, that's like,
and it's also hard to just be like, we're going to say no to all of you so that we can get an equal mix of every type of person in the room. But also, I don't think it's necessarily bad to have a quota, because at a certain level, everyone can do a certain type of writing. And on a late night show, it's so much easier to just get every type of person in a room, because there are a lot of people of like different sexuality and different races, different genders. They can do the writing just as well as the 17 white guys can. So in a show like that.
So it's like, why not?
Exactly.
And especially when it's like, if Late Show with Colbert, how many writers are on Midnight?
I want to say like 8 or so.
Okay. So less.
Probably less than that.
But still, at a certain number of writers, it's not like, well, 3 guys kind of do all of it. It's like it's so spread out that might as well.
Might as well. Just,
quotas are interesting.
I think quotas are good for when the work is like a late night thing. And that's not to shit on late night at all, because it takes a lot of work to do it. But it's also, it's not work that it's like we have to have the single best writer in the city here. It's stuff that's like we have to have very good writers that are very good at working together. And, you know, all sorts of people can do that. And maybe it's just like you don't necessarily have the time to be like, well, we got a bunch of good ones, but also let's find the racially diverse ones. But maybe, I don't know.
How do you think the problem gets solved over time?
I think the problem gets solved over time. I don't know, because I think it is just a problem of there being like, you know, if you got, you know, statistically, if you have 70 brown M&Ms and 3 green M&Ms, more often than not, it's going to be easier to pick the brown M&Ms. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think, you know, filtering through the bowl to pick the green M&Ms is better. I just think you got to get more green M&Ms in there, even out the pool.
Right.
So.
But that's, I guess it's like what we were talking about with female late night hosts. It's easier to do when there's more models.
Yeah.
You know? Like how many...
But how do you get those models in there?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I guess it's... Oh, you know what I think about? I think about that Papa Pope, as much as we kind of hate on Scandal, which I do enjoy as a show, that Papa Pope quote, you know what I'm going to say?
No.
You have to be twice as good.
Yes. And my parents have been telling me that since I was a kid. And when I was a kid, I was frustrated. But now I'm just kind of like, fuck, they were right. And when I was a kid, it's so weird because I think of that kind of a speech as like a, oh, God, parents don't understand. Like, racism isn't here anymore. But as I grow older, I'm just kind of like, it is. It's just... It's hidden, you know?
And or it's not even racism. It's just like numbers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the numbers are racist.
Right. And the numbers are just a factor of, you know, people not being encouraged to do those things because they've been told and shown that it's not their world, you know?
Like how many young Indian comedians will go into show business now because they saw Aziz or Kumail or Asif even, you know?
It's great to see diversity in I think, honestly, stand-up is one of the best worlds for diversity in comedy now. Because they're getting way better at it. You know, Aziz and Kumail and fucking, like, Gerard Carmichael and all these greats are coming through the woodwork, and they're diverse and they're brilliant. And people are seeing, like, it's not a matter of, like... You know, only the minorities that get big are the ones who are like, you know, George Lopez and stuff. Like, all different worlds across stand-up comedy are crazy diverse, and I think that's great.
You know where I'd love to see more of it?
What?
And this kind of actually goes back to the original question about, is comedy gendered? But name as many mainstream, successful lesbian comedians as you can.
Tig Notaro... Cameron Esposito,
I don't know if she's mainstream.
She's going to be in Mother's Day.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wait, the Gary Marshall movie?
Yeah. Please call me Gary.
Do you know what that means?
Paul F. Tompkins?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That means there's going to be a movie interruption of Mother's Day at Cine Family in like 2 years.
Yeah.
And because the last one that they did, New Year's Eve, they did a movie interruption of it. It's the show Doug Benson runs, and they have comedians, and they do basically a Mystery Science Theater 3000 of it in real time and live, and it's not scripted.
I still haven't been to one. I was going to go to Entourage.
It's amazing. Entourage was great. It's John Hamm and Zach Galifianakis. But
really?
Every time they do a Gary Marshall movie, they did Valentine's Day, and they did New Year's Eve, and they always have Paul F. Tompkins as Gary Marshall doing the interruption. And it is the last time I saw it, like the New Year's Eve, it was like December 2013. And it's the longest I've sustained laughing over a course of time. Yeah. Usually I get a good hour in me or an hour and a half. It was 2 hours of just like Tompkins crushing it.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the question. Tig Notaro, Cameron Esposito. We'll say Ellen DeGeneres. We'll say Rosie O'Donnell.
Right.
Technically. Now name all the successful mainstream male gay comedians.
Sean Hayes, is he gay?
Is he a comedian, though?
Oh, that's true. I was also going to say Jim What's-It from Big Bang Theory.
Jim Parsons.
Yeah.
But comedians, like stand-ups.
Guy Branum, no.
Yeah, if you go into alt, there's Todd Glass, Guy Branum, James Adomian, Gabe Liebman.
Yeah.
But it's not... You know what I mean? Like, there's so many, so much less in the mainstream because there's not as many.
Huh.
I really, like, I can't even think of, like, the biggest male gay comedian.
Giorgio. He's not the biggest. He's just also in the alt. Solomon Giorgio, who's, I would put in the alt thing also. Huh. I never think about that. That's weird.
Yeah. Male gay, and my thought on that is it because do those... lesbian stand-ups project what people would call a more quote-unquote male comedy than gay men do.
And maybe.
You know what I mean? So, I don't know. It's just interesting to think about.
It also might just be homophobia of, like, middle America still doesn't want to hear, like, gay men talking about their sexual experiences.
Sure.
Whereas, like, with... women, it's still like women, which is like half a disrespect and half a, you know, like I can think of it in a way that is good for me. It's like, I don't know.
That's true. Yeah.
we spent a lot of time on that question.
I think it was worth talking about
for sure.
Watch The Late Show, Stephen Colbert. I've been watching it this week.
I only saw the musical performances by Kendrick and the Paul Simon cover band, which was great.
That was such a fun bit.
Yeah. And I wish he'd gotten a real cover band. Like, I wish he'd just been like, here you go, here's your spot.
That's like, funny.
That would have been just a cool thing to do, right. But I'm glad that we saw Paul Simon. And I saw the intro of his show. I saw it once, and the song is stuck in my head. It's a great intro.
Frickin' John Baptiste, man.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's going to set him apart from everyone else, is the mobility of his band leader.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That he can do the melodica thing, like, anywhere on the stage,
yeah.
And, like, he was in the balcony.
I really should watch a full... I also like that he's his own announcer. Couple.
I love that too.
Yeah,
actually, I think that's great.
Does he not have a sidekick?
No.
That's fun.
I think his sidekick at this point is John Baptiste.
That's fun. I should watch.
Which hopefully
episode.
Will be better than Kevin Eubanks, or Paul Schaefer.
Mm.
Fire alarm laugh. Ah.
I think Letterman's show is like. The death of Letterman's show is like them going like comedy is finally new again. Just because he was the last old comic where it's just like the, I tell you what, I adjust my tie. Oh, what do you think, Paul? Yeah, I think the same thing. Oh, who? Give me the bells. Like, it's just a, like, I think that type of comedy in late night at least is dead, which is cool.
You know what's for sure dead, I think?
What?
You cannot be a jerk anymore.
Mm,
you have
no.
to be nice.
Yeah.
They went to great lengths to that in Colbert's show. Like, Letterman's a jerk. And, like, that's part of the thing on the show. It's like, I'm going to be a jerk to Paris Hilton and ask her about her jail time, like, 20 times.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to... Here's why the real thing... I don't care. But the real thing I was worried about with Colbert's show is that they were doing it in the Ed Sullivan Theater, which is the same theater that they did Letterman's show in. And I think overall, and I think it's a theory widely shared by a lot of people, is that comedy works best in compressed spaces and smaller spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, like... Conan show, like the, you know, the first one, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, that was in the small studio 8H or whatever, or not this, the one below Saturday Night Live. Like,
yeah.
It's good in smaller spaces. And what happened at Letterman's show is they would clap for anything halfway
right.
funny. It would be an applause break in a way that was not motivated or reflected reality. I felt like I was losing my mind so many times I was watching Letterman's show. But thankfully with Colbert, they've made the space a little bit smaller. And maybe they're miking the audience differently, but they're not as applause happy.
I think just less people means that, because if anyone applauds in the audience, the rest of the audience follows suit.
I hope so. Or maybe just one guy was on Letterman's show and he was just trigger happy with that applause button. Because it was, watch any episode of Letterman.
It really
is. It is
bad.
Infuriating.
They do it when he's doing the affair confession.
He said, I slept with other women and they applauded in the most confused applause break of all time,
yeah.
I think.
Which, anyway.
Also, but to be fair, it is driving me nuts at the end of Colbert Report, too. Because people were like, whoa, Stephen!
People just loved Colbert, I think.
Right. Well, but then people do it on Stewart, too, to the point where it disrupts timing of the comedy. Because then you have to account for, okay, well, there's going to be 40 seconds of dumb tourists coming in to applaud.
Because there's a lot of, like, gotcha jokes where it's like, that's funny, and also it takes down this person in a very good way.
It's what...
Brilliant,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just a lot of...
I think it was Norm MacDonald or someone called it clapter. Have you heard this? So clapter is when you clap at something, not because... You think it's particularly funny, but because you agree with it. So yes. It's like George Bush is a war criminal.
Right. It's that kind of thing where they're just like, can't believe finally someone has the guts to say it. And it's not necessarily, it's like a lot of people are saying it.
Which just, is,
this is the biggest way. This is the biggest person to you.
Which is actually the best part of, or not the best part, but one of the best parts about John Oliver's show is that his points are so nuanced and not particularly partisan. Because it's like municipal violations. That's not. I don't know if per se people would say, oh, that's a Democrat issue or a Republican issue. So they're so nuanced that the audience doesn't know when to clap.
Mm-hmm.
So his timing is not interrupted.
I love that John Oliver also goes after smaller things like evangelism rather than all of the Democratic, like all of the Republican Party, something like, or FIFA corruption.
Yeah.
Or like it's
and
really just
a particular sect of evangelism.
And I don't know if it's like a European thing or if it's just that he is trying to go after the things that even like no one genuinely is talking about. Like, because people are like Colbert and Stewart go after the things no one's talking about, but it's always just like the politicians that people are kind of talking
Trump's
about.
Donald Trump's weird.
They're setting up, at a certain point they set the bar for what people were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So Oliver is like, well, if I can do that now, I'm going to set the bar for things that are smaller, but people should know about.
It's so smart. It
people
reminds me.
Stand up for.
Yeah. In the early years of Colbert Report, when he would do The Word on like a regular basis, which is still one of the most brilliant segments of all time in any late night show. But like the essay like depth he would go after one topic in, all while doing like this like amazing verbal gymnastics of like making jokes, making points, doing it from a character, so it's satire, so basically tap dancing backwards and heels. Like that's what John Oliver reminds me of now because of the depth at which he approaches things, which is awesome. Also, you know what, you know who was Colbert's head writer for 3-4 years? Alison Silverman, a woman on Colbert Report. So again, like it's not like he's sexist, but it's just
again, it's the it's the M&M thing.
Yeah, it's
there's
the
just
system.
More in the bowl. So you try to grab a handful, you grab less of the whatever. Yeah. Anyway,
Tallulah on Twitter.
We still doing this?
No. Yeah. We'll wrap it up soon.
Let's go.
She says, well, I think her name's Becca, and she said the gritty remake. Here's her pitch: the gritty remake. We find out Kirk is Lorelai's half-brother, Richard's illegitimate son. Richard has been paying money to a secret account for the last 30-plus years. That is why Kirk has so many odd jobs over the years and always has money to eat at Luke's diner every day.
Well, I'm really glad she didn't accept him on that date then.
Yeah. That makes that very dark.
I don't know if that goes dark as much as it just goes like, here's some backstory, but I think that would be fun just because it means that the Gilmores would have to sort of, you think they'd bring Kirk into Friday night dinners and just, it'd be a thing where like Emily and Richard can't stand him, but eventually he's like, look, you don't have to bring me into this family. It was your choice to deal with this the way you did. And I didn't want any of it. I took all these jobs to pay you back so I could finally just get out of this. And you don't owe me anything, all right? I don't want anything from you, but I'm going to keep doing things the way I do them. And if you don't like that, then you can shove off. Or, well, it's HBO, so they'd go, you can fuck off. And we get that powerful fuck from Kurt. And then we'd sort of respect Kurt in a way, but at the same time, we'd get this dimension to Kurt that's like, he's a buffoon, but he's also working hard to, like, you know, get out of the people that are treating him like he's a buffoon.
Mm.
Which would be cool.
There's layers, man.
There really are.
Especially on HBO. Andrea writes, I think this is important because we probably, I don't know, but we'll talk about it. She says, I listened to 215, wanted to add something about Kevin's comment about women watching those Thin and Beautiful Gilmores eating like human garbage bags, which they do, and wondering if us ladies might be upset by it. Because it's like a weird thing. And I've heard, you know, people complain like, oh, you know, they eat so much, but they stay so thin, blah, blah, blah. We are used to This is Andrew talking. We are used to completely unattainable and unfair beauty standards in pretty much everything in our entertainment. The fact that the Gilmores ate so much and it had no ramifications never bothered me, actually. I don't know any other show where they actually show women eating and have it be a part of their characters. Or I can't think of any. I'd say 30 Rock. That's kind of a part of Liz's character.
Yeah.
Working on my night cheese.
Some jack cheese, put it in a hot dog, stuff it in a pizza.
You got cheese.
You got cheesy blasters.
Yeah, you got cheesy blasts.
Love it.
But the point of that was show women eating and have it be a part of their characters and enjoy that. Most shows show women eating salads or nothing at all, and there always seems to be a scene of them running or taking yoga classes with their friends. Not sure how that would play with Lorelai and Rory. Anyway, I enjoy the food part because that actually influenced me as a teenager to eat what I wanted, but way more in moderation than the Gilmore Girls. And we don't get that message very often.
Yeah.
So there is a weird, like, dualistic, like, it's a dream, you know, it's like crazy that
it's
they
good
eat
to
so
show
much.
Them, yeah.
But at the same time, it is validating for women to see, like, yeah, just eat food. Just
right.
Don't be a monster about it like Lorelai and Rory are maybe sometimes. But yeah. Like,
I think it is good that they sometimes make the joke of how crazy it is they eat so much, but also they don't turn into like, this is a problem, you should be eating less.
Right.
They're just kind of like, what? Fuck you.
Wow, that sounded a little bit like Keon there at the end.
You should be eating less.
You should
Lane,
be
should be
less.
Eating more, for all the food I've given you is poisoned. How does it taste, Lane? Do you taste the anthrax?
Okay, let's do one more email.
One more email before I go. I don't know.
To the valley below.
Oh, is that it?
Is that what it is?
I don't know.
There's one more cup of coffee before I go.
Sure is.
Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then.
Bob Dylan.
Okay.
Covered by the White Stripes.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, the White Stripes covered everything.
Well, not everything. Cut to Family Guy cutaway of them covering Believe It or Not. I'd listen to that. Jack.
Believe it or not.
By the way, someone tweeted us this video of Milo Ventimiglia in Heroes, and he comes.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yes.
So, okay, for the listener at home, and I don't know what episode it is. I didn't research it. I never watched Heroes. Did you?
I watched a few episodes, and I was like, this isn't working.
Right. But there's this scene where Milo goes into this hospital, or Pier Petrelli, whatever his name is, on the show. And he goes into this hospital, and he sees a children's choir singing...
Believe
it or not, Last Great American Hero theme song.
Yeah.
It's so strange that that it's associated with two kids. Anyway, so that's interesting. That's a fun thing.
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I'd feel so free. Believe it or not, something is something. Who could it be? Believe it or not, it's just me.
Actually, you know what? Let's just go to the voicemails.
Let's go to the voicemails. Today.
I love that theme song. I love it so.
Well, you're in luck. Well, you're in bad luck, that is, because it's never coming back. I already forgot it.
But I can play this back for you later.
Oh, thank God.
Okay, here we go. Here's the voicemail. I haven't screened this one.
Always good.
Okay, but it's 20 seconds long.
Hey, motherfucker.
I think. I hope not. But here's what I'd say about voicemails for the Gilmail guys episodes. I'd say, because there's been a few, I think on our voicemail message, it says like, leave a short one, leave a long one, whatever. But then sometimes people leave them longer than 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's hard to play them. And it cuts off after 3 minutes.
Honestly, longer than a minute is hard to do.
Yeah.
So if you leave us a voicemail, which you should, we'd love to get them, make it short.
Yeah, I'd say under a minute.
And make it more of a, like, not that we don't appreciate your appreciation, but we can't do much on air with you just telling us you love the show or saying that you've watched the show for a while.
I still appreciate those.
Yes.
You can send them in, obviously.
Right.
But I for the purposes of this particular kind of episode.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so this is 20 seconds long. So
cool.
We'll listen.
Hey, Kevin and Demi. My name is Ellen, and I'm calling from Michigan. My question is, how do you think this podcast has changed you? Maybe in regards to your relationships or career goals. I'm just curious how your sense of self has changed over the past year. Have a good day, and I can't wait for the new episode tomorrow. Bye.
That is a good question.
It's great. See, she gets it. It's like she heard us all the way from
Was that
Los Angeles.
Voicemail made from outside, like 10 seconds ago?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Wow. Oh, wow.
How have we changed? I mean, it's so loaded, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot has changed in the last year.
Part of me feels like nothing has changed.
Really?
For me.
In your sense of self or identity?
Yes.
Or in your career?
In my career, definitely a lot has changed. But I don't think that my sense of self has changed much.
I'm a completely different person.
Which is a boring answer, I'm sure, but I'm trying to think
of, but that's interesting.
The way I did things before. I think that talking more and just being able to say stuff like this, even just the discussion we had about like late night stuff and diversity is something, well, that's not necessarily, I love the ability to talk about it more because it makes me more confident in talking about it with people and just the idea that like I have a platform to say those kind of things now that isn't just, you know, typing very short messages on Twitter is great. And I love that. And I think it's made me more aware of the things that I say and sort of even just having a podcast that some would consider popular makes me aware of the thing that like just everything I say is like it can be unimportant, but if I'm trying to say something important, I have to recognize that there are people who are listening to it. And there are I also have to recognize that, like, you know, it's that whole thing of like evil only works when good men do nothing or whatever. But I have to realize that if I don't use this platform to also say good things, that's, you know, that's not great. So it's lovely. It's cool to know that this is, you know, that I hope that I have changed in the way of like using this platform for good and understanding that
not using it for evil like you used to.
Right.
When like you I would say, guys, here's how to make a bomb.
Exactly. There was a lot of anarchist cookbook readings in the first season, which I'm glad we stopped. But
how did this get made? Bombs.
Right. how did this get? It is bonkers,
guys. Yeah.
Bombs are deeply and what does she say? This is absolutely upsetting or something. Deeply
this
upsetting.
This is so upsetting.
Yes. This bomb was deeply upsetting. But aside from that, I don't think it's changed me much.
I feel like here's what I hope has changed. I hope we've become better podcasters in the last year. I hope. I think we have.
Probably.
Probably a little bit, maybe.
At least a little.
Slightly.
Although, you know, it's weird. I've never listened to podcasts less than while doing one.
Well, I feel like that is common, yeah. Though. The rapper.
Right.
Wait, is he a rapper or a singer?
Is.
Okay.
No, he's a rapper.
It's like 50-50.
Look, you took a shot and you hit the bullseye.
But no, because like people, Joss Whedon said, you can either make TV or watch it. You can't do both. Like, yeah. You know, like, do you want to, you know, we hit stop on the recorder, then you get in the car and listen to more podcasts.
Right.
Now, maybe I'm a weirdo because I actually do that.
I try, but sometimes I get in the car and I'm driving and I'm listening to even the podcast that I love. I'm just like, I can't do it right now. I got to listen to music or something I can just either enact with it and sing along or just space out. Something where I don't have to listen to words. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So hopefully I'd say the ways I've changed is I've become a better podcaster, a better lover.
I've definitely become a better lover, and my paramours have taken notice.
Your
and
paramours.
They've given credit to the Gilmore guys. They've said, thank God you do that podcast because you're way better in the sack now.
I sincerely think I've changed a lot in the last year, but one thing that's measurable and I think is due to doing the show and specifically doing it with you and kind of what you've been talking about is I find myself in a good way expressing more sensitivity to more things.
Right.
Because I think about if I was to say something about this to X amount of people, which is like more than an immediate friend circle or family or whatever, what would I want to say about it? And
right.
Really processing that in a way that's helpful and is, not evil. So I think that is a way in which I've changed. And like, and I think I talked about it on a live show one time, but like, I've also developed less patience for stuff that isn't that is more shoddily done women wise, like anything that's like, she's thy candy and here she is in underwear, or right. here she is run through heels, and like, you know.
You know what's done that for me is Twitter, actually. At some point, I want to say it was probably like a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, I got really into reading about feminism through, because it was just like, there were a bunch of women on Twitter that I followed because they were funny, and they would also just talk about women's issues in an open and frank way, and they would like post links to articles that were really
open
interesting.
Open and frank.
Yeah.
Not Anne Frank.
Right, open and frank. No, open and
that's
frank.
It's like a weird command for a door to a synagogue.
Open and frank. No, but they would talk about it in an open and frank way that made me really interested, and they would just mention things that I never even think about, just in how women interact with each other for their own well-being, and how men interact with each in with women in a way that is like very subtly coded, and even just like even people of color like on Twitter in the same way, like reading about their interactions and how you know, women and people of color are like have sort of microaggressions leveled against them that aren't necessarily these big overwrought like people calling them bad words, but like the way they're treated in such small ways. And I thought, the more I thought about that, the more I was like, I'm glad I'm aware of this now, right. But I also, I can't, it's not enough to just be aware of it. I have to, you know, actively make the decision to be better about it and to sort of not speak out always, but to, you know, acknowledge and like call out when men or, you know, people who aren't of color are doing these things that I see. And it's just like, it's hard to always come to terms with being that person, but it's like, if I think I've always said that as much as it's great to be a good person, I think trying to be a good person is even better. And it's hard to do because sometimes trying to be a good person
is
means,
that from something, or is that a Demi Adigwebea Ridge?
I mean, I've been saying that for a while. But
yeah, because I've heard it before. I'm trying to figure out if it was from you.
Probably. I said it earlier today.
Yeah.
Too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I think it's just very important. But it's also so difficult because trying to be a good person often means doing things that aren't necessarily as fun or exciting, or like aren't immediately like a boon to your like dopamine levels or whatever, like making you happy, making you feel good. Cause sometimes it's really good, like it's really fun and just feels better to be the like not be the buzzkill or whatever.
Sin.
To sin. Yeah, to sin. But not even.
I mean, well, maybe that's one way to put
not
it.
Not even necessarily to sin, cause sometimes it's just to be passive and to let things fly. And I think that some people see people
who. A sin
of
omission.
Right. And sometimes people see the person who like actively goes, hey, that was kind of racist, or hey, you shouldn't say that word, it's pretty loaded, as being the buzzkill, which is fair, but it also sucks to be that person when you're not trying to be like, how dare you, you're just trying to be like I just want you to know.
Yeah,
you
it's
want
more
them to
of
be
an
a better
FYI.
Person.
Yes. You know what it is? It's like when you are in the car and someone tries to cut you off on accident,
right.
A lot of times, and you honk the horn,
mm-hmm.
And it's more like an instructive, don't do that because you're going to hit me.
Yeah.
And that's what that is. But oftentimes it's taken as just laying on
exactly.
The horn with like, you know, venomous intent,
right.
Or something.
Or it's that feeling of being an adult and being like yelled at by another adult in public, even though you know when you did something wrong, you're just like, how dare you? Now I feel like shit. How could you do this to me?
I tell you what, though, I mean, that is still like on every level, I guess it, both parties in that exchange, but man, being told you're wrong as an adult,
it sucks. It really
it's so
does.
Bad.
It's embarrassing and it makes you feel awful. But at the same time, it's like
it's necessary,
right?
It,
and it would
it
be great if it could, like, if we could just be like, I wish it was socially like just a reflex, like a muscle for people to be told they're wrong and be like, oh, okay, sorry about that. Instead of like taking it with them and just like taking it as this deep shame, like a dog, or being like feeling like they're a child again for the like first time in years, which is the feeling of being told you're wrong or being berated in public. But I just wish that it wasn't our first nature to regress to that point of being like, oh, this reminds me of being a kid again and like feeling uncomfortable. I wish it was just like, you know, adults are always learning. Sorry about that. How are you? Like, I wish it was just a casual, like it was like small
yeah.
talk. Anyway,
no, but that's such a salient point. Yeah. We're trying to
so shout out
men.
To you know social Twitter.
I feel like the show has really changed my life in a lot of ways, though, that I'm not getting into right now. I don't know, like even
well,
just
you're taller for one.
Yeah, which Richard's obsessed with. You're tall.
I'll talk about that in 507 because he has an obsession.
Yep. We'll just leave it at that for now. While doing this episode, we've received a new voicemail.
No way.
I'll play that.
Let's play it right now.
It's 59 seconds. Not a minute.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Hi, Kevin and Demi. I'm Rachel. I'm a sophomore in college, and I have to say how much I love listening to your guys' show. I am a huge fan of The More Girls Than Have Been since I was in middle school, and
useless
now I'm studying
so
a degree in literature, much like Rory. My question, which I don't really know if there is an answer to, is today, do you think Rory would have an e-reader, or if she would only buy physical books? Being a literature major is a really big conflict between myself and my fellow peers, as well as many of my professors who are very against it. Just wanted to say again how much I love the show, and I can't wait to hear you guys get through the rest of the show, and I'm very excited for Bunheads. And also wanted to thank you, because I've gone through a shitty breakup, and this has super helped me. You guys are great. I love the show, and boy with the poodles already.
What does that mean?
I've never heard that before in my life.
Did she say poodles?
What a random thing to say.
That's so random.
No.
Okay, so the question is, would Rory have an e-reader or would she stick to print?
So, there are two answers because there are two choices. So I guess we have to examine. Personally, I'm very pro-physical books just because it's easier to read and it's less of a strain. Like, I can just, like, if I'm reading something.
Even Kindles, even e-ink?
I think it's just also less distracting to be able to read in a way that I have to physically flip a book and like measure something on the page. And it's just, I don't know. I think e-ink is way more convenient. And the idea that I can carry 1,000 books with me wherever I go and just choose one is the most incredible technological marvel. And I think that's something Rory would appreciate. Mm-hmm. But I also think she'd be a bit of a snob about it.
I think she'd be a snob too.
Yeah.
I think she would try to. Well, let's say, she's a successful reporter and she has a lot of money. I think she would have a dedicated study. I think she is the kind of, just like her mom has her, quirks and tendencies. And it's like, well, it's just my way and I just want to do it my way. Yeah. Rory would not go for the convenience factor.
I definitely think she'd be a book person.
Yeah.
She'd probably make a remark about it too. Like, well, you have a lot of books. I haven't heard of an e-reader. I've heard of an e-reader. I've just also heard of a bunch of other things. I'm not an idiot or something like that.
Go F yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do one more V-mail.
Yeah.
One more V-mail. This is 31 seconds long. That's pretty good.
It's a good number, 31.
31.
When I was 31,
hey guys, I had a few very good ones. I'm calling with a quick question. I want to know about I think you've watched the I Jump, You Jump once. That means you've seen the one with the gorilla mask. But I was just wondering if there was any reason particular they wore a gorilla mask, or if it could be any animal and it was just to conceal the identity of the person in the mask. And if so, if you could have chosen a mask to conceal your identity, what animal would you choose? Okay, thank you. Bye.
Well, I guess this is relevant because this will come out after 506.
Should we release this after 507 also, or does it matter?
It won't matter.
Okay.
Because everything I've said last episode a lot of times about 506.
Right. Okay. So we, just as a disclaimer for anyone who's about to listen to this part, if you haven't watched 507, we'll briefly talk about the gorilla mask thing, which is also in 506.
So it's fine. Yeah.
So,
there's no given.
Literally no reason.
And it doesn't fit with the, I guess unless, they kind of do an out of Africa thing in 507. That's generally the aesthetic of like the campground and everything.
Yeah.
So maybe like the gorillas in Africa? I don't know.
But there's every animal in Africa. I don't know.
There's really no, there's no given reason. I think it was just like, this is less creepy looking than a monkey mask or a horse head mask. So
and
if we were to do it for
out of lion masks.
Right. So if we were to do it for our own society, it would be.
By the way, can I just quickly?
Yes.
Sorry, that's a 507 thing. Never mind.
You want to rant about it tomorrow?
I have to write it down. There, I have a lot of things to say about 507, and I'm worried we won't have time.
Time. You know, we're gonna have more time.
That's true, but even then, somehow I'm just like, I got a lot. No, but
I know.
I'll deal
with clips and stuff.
Yeah.
If for my secret society, maybe cute little doggy masks because I like dogs.
Right.
And if dogs were people, if people were dogs, rather, I'd like people more.
Like a vinyl dog mask, like a dog EV?
Hey, it's the newest member of the entourage, Doggy V.
Doggy V is here.
Which I think someone chose as their username in the Wee Gilly forums.
Yeah, Annie did.
Doggy, yeah, Annie did. Doggy V. Oh, man. You know what? Because we were like, do we answer this? Let's go out with one more.
All right.
Go out with one more V-mail. Here we go.
Yo, longtime Gilly from California.
Yeah.
My name is Manuel, and I had a question. Do you guys have a fear that with season seven coming up, that without Paladino influence, the Pop Goes the Culture might be a little limited? I haven't really reviewed it. I don't really watch season seven a lot, but I think that segment might have to go away.
Just is he threatening it?
It better go away.
Have a good one.
It sound like a real genuine
I thought
threat.
He was just going to stop it. Do you guys have a fear?
What is it?
And I was going to be like, oh, okay.
I do now, sir.
Yeah, it's you. No, I will say how excited I am for season seven, because a shift means that it's going to be very interesting for us to talk about. Mm-hmm. And also, it would probably turn into a how did this get made thing, where we're just ripping it apart because we love it so much.
We'll see.
And
yeah.
Also, again, we'll do the bright side thing where we just go,
Mr. Bright Side.
I really do want to have like a xylophone, like, all right, and now it's time for the bright side. Do, 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 do.
Yeah.
This episode was fun because, and I love this.
I like this episode.
Yeah.
Because
this was a nice part of this. But
I've heard, I don't know because I haven't watched it, but I've heard it does indeed get a lot thinner with pop culture refs. And
we'll still do Pop Goes the Culture, just be smaller.
We'll do it as much as we can.
Yeah.
But it may be smaller.
And we'll tackle the dumb references that they use, I guess.
Well, like we tackle them now.
Yeah. But I'm saying, like, if it's all, there's one where they reference Fast and Furious, I've heard. So if it's just all, like, movies that came out that week, we'll just be like, this is really stupid. This is all movies that came out.
There's a Paladino reference to Jay-Z in season six.
Oh, good.
Can't wait.
I hope it's Put Your Diamonds Up.
Or
The Rock
like
is
that.
In the building.
Well, that was fun. Hope you guys enjoyed talking about the history of late night television.
Yeah. Hope you guys like talking about, you know, feminism, diversity.
It's worth discussing, man.
Right.
That's what Gil Mail is all about. You open the mailbag, but what you might find in there,
some brown M&Ms. I'm going back to my own metaphor.
And two green ones?
That's right.
Perhaps.
La 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 la.
Oh yeah. Send us your questions and mail GilmoreGuysShow@gmail.com. We will respond to all of them eventually. We're getting better. We've answered hundreds in the last couple weeks. That's true. And then you can call in to leave a quickie voicemail and leave a question. 772-934-4559. 772-934-WEE-GILLY.
You can also go to GilmoreGuysShow.com if any of that information was incorrect and see the correct version there, because we don't... is that the real number? Do we know?
772-934-4559?
Yeah, you just seemed unsure about it, so just go to the website.
Wait, let me see. Wait,
you can go 772-934. To our website.
No, I got it right!
Hooray!
Yay! Woo! Goodbye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.